This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, November 30th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, "Foo, China's COVID grip distressing." China Aid founder warns lockdowns have turned country into a concentration camp. By Ben Schaffer. In a rare display of displeasure not seen since the protests at Tiananmen Square 33 years ago, protests arose around China due to suffocating COVID-19 lockdown measures over the weekend. Bob Fu of Midland's China Aid said China's recent lockdowns, in accordance with its zero COVID policy, has turned the country into a national concentration camp for the last 110 days. According to Fu, Chinese citizens in more than 18 out of 30 provinces and students from nearly 100 universities have taken to the streets in peaceful protest to express their discontent with COVID restrictions and call for the resignation of Xi Jinping, president of the Chinese Communist Party. Fu said Chinese citizens who live in the least restricted cities may have the freedom to walk around their neighborhood and return to their home. However, most of China, including in major cities and provinces like Zhejiang, do not allow citizens to leave their home. One of my staff at China Aid in Midland, her parents were both locked inside their house for over a month already. Their door was sealed by Communist Party officials, Fu said. To ensure compliance with COVID lockdowns, the Chinese Communist Party has employed advanced surveillance technology for the past 3 years. COVID surveillance has enabled the Communist Party to have the most sophisticated form of digital tyranny, he said. He added that what began as COVID surveillance tactics have turned into total political espionage against Chinese citizens. Fu outlined the risk Chinese protesters are taking by speaking out against totalitarian rule. "Every one of them are risking their lives," he said. "Under Xi Jinping's ruthless rule, just speaking to a reporter is a crime. Using Twitter in Beijing, the police are checking your phone, and if you install Twitter, VPN, or Telegram apps, that's a crime." Protesters identified by law enforcement and the CCP will be arrested, physically harmed, or have opportunities for a prosperous life, like educational opportunities, taken away without exception and for generations to come, Fu said. Leaders in free countries with an established democracy need to speak up and stand in solidarity with the brave protesters, according to Fu. Fu said a weekend statement made by the White House claimed that prominent U.S. leaders, like President Biden, were watching the protests unfold. "Watching, watching. On the matter of good, evil, right, and wrong, you're not watching," Fu said. "That means inaction. Inaction in itself is action. Not to speak is speaking," like Martin Luther King Jr. said. Fu said world leaders shouldn't send the wrong passive message to CCP leaders and should send a clear message in solidarity with the protesters. "In Texas, I would also ask our governor and members of the Texas House and Senate to speak up as well," Fu remarked. Fu said serious consequences will come to those who protested this weekend. "The Communist Party now doesn't really need to send a tank. They just need to hit a button and then lock you down. You are treated as a poison to society. Their protesters' job will be gone, their family's future will be gone," he said. This article is entitled "MISD's Search for Next Leader Down to Three" by Stuart Doreen. The Midland ISD board has narrowed down its list of superintendent candidates to three. Board President Brian Murray told the Reporter Telegram on Monday night that the board met with five candidates earlier in the day, and that three will be brought back for more in-depth questioning next week. the MISD board is looking for the person to replace Angelica Ramsey, who left Midland ISD to take the same position at Fort Worth ISD. Kelly Spencer has served as the acting superintendent. Murray told the Reporter-Telegram the three returning candidates have strong ties to West Texas. He added they are all sitting superintendents, and two come from similar districts in terms of demographics and academic achievement. The other person invited back comes from a different situation in terms of demographics and achievement, but Murray said this person has interviewed well for Midland's seven-person board. The board asked all five candidates the same questions during Monday's round. Murray said he has been pleased with the process so far, and he expects a new superintendent to be in place no later than February. Texas law calls for a 21-day waiting period after a school superintendent finalist is named. Texas law also allows for a district to not have to provide names of those candidates who applied for the position or those who interviewed. This article is entitled, Cast Crew Showcase Talent in A Christmas Carol. Holiday Show Upholds Impressive Legacy of Midland Theater. By Morgan Taylor Thomas. Each performance I attend at the Midland Community Theater leaves me more impressed than the time before, and A Christmas Carol remains no exception. The largest cast I've seen on the Davis Theater One stage since moving to the Tall City this summer, each actor and actress stood individually and purposefully without blurring together into one moving mass. Opening night jitters fell absent, even with a full house, and the hour-and-a-half runtime felt comfortable and nostalgic. As main hitter Ebenezer Scrooge, Jonathan Horne gave a stellar performance, hunched back and all. A fair comparison to the Scrooge I remember from childhood. Horne encompassed the miser's mannerisms and attitude to a T, all while reciting perfectly memorized lines and stage cues. Furthermore, Horne balanced the scale between kid-focused humor and adult themes, making the story enjoyable for patrons of all ages. Countering Horne stood Kevin Loeffler as Bob Cratchit, the family-focused gentleman with a big heart and plenty of holiday spirit. Even though someone familiar with A Christmas Story would expect Cratchit to be a down-to-earth character, I could see Loeffler didn't need to dig very deep to find this characteristic. The proof? During one scene, an actor posing as Cratchit's son, Tiny Tim, accidentally dropped his wooden crutch. Without hesitation, Loeffler bent down to pick it up, as any father would, and seamlessly added the minor mistake into the scene. One aspect I originally questioned before sitting down for the 7:30 p.m. showing dealt with the LED wall debut. Would the lights be distracting to the audience? Would they be too bright? How would this affect the actors and actresses? However, the LED wall almost became invisible. By adding depth and allowing the performers to maintain more space on stage, it enhanced the display, forcing audience members to focus on the performers, as it should be. Overall, to miss this holiday classic would be a mistake. Beyond the idea of supporting the local arts, the cast and crew of A Christmas Carol showcase Midland talent through a large age range, both remarkable and encouraging. Also, an enduring sentiment focused on the importance of kindness, something everyone could use a playful reminder of this festive season. The show will run at 7:30 p.m. December 2nd and 3rd, 9th and 10th, and 16th and 17th. The 2:30 p.m. performances take place December 11th and 18th. To buy tickets, visit www.mctmidland.org. For a full cast listing, visit MRT's previous article. This column is also called Our View. It is entitled Help Wanted, Same Song, Different Verse in Midland. By Stuart Doreen, editor. There aren't enough workers in Midland. The signs are all around us. Help Wanted signs, 2.9% unemployment and falling, construction projects not completed, restaurants running at less than full occupancy, and others requiring drive-through customers to wait 30 minutes for an order. The lack of available workers makes this community less safe. See the number of first responder vacancies, and is likely the greatest factor in a quality of place that is less than some would like. We have a problem with no solution. Midland isn't the only place. A recent Dallas Morning News article stated that in September, Texas had nearly 1.03 million job openings, the most ever and nearly twice the number before the pandemic, according to data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. That translates into almost 1.8 openings for every unemployed Texan. But we live in Midland, and this is same song, different verse. Maybe this time it didn't feel like it came out of nowhere, like has been the case during previous times of economic prosperity. However, it is happening. The lack of available help again plagues our community. When the new year hits, the Reporter Telegram will look at our help wanted situation and how it is impacting different businesses and professions, how it impacts what we do and we want to do on a regular basis, how some businesses effectively get around the problem, and what potential solutions are available, if any. If there is anyone who wants to let the Reporter Telegram know about your business's hiring difficulties or successes, send me a message, sdoreen@hearstnp.com. This is the opinion page. This column is called Our View. It is entitled, Nonprofits Could Use Reporter Telegram for Fundraising Pitches. December is a popular month for making year-end asks. This will probably not come as a surprise to many in Midland. Still, 31% of all annual giving in the U.S. occurs in December, according to the website www.donorbox.org. So, in the midst of the so-called giving season, the Reporter Telegram wants to invite any nonprofit to make its case for that December donation. Make your case to our readers in the paper and online why your organization is the right place for a last-minute piece of philanthropy. Here are the requirements. The item should be no longer than 600 words. It should be written on a Word document and emailed to sdoreen@hearstnp.com. Feel free to include a picture attached as a JPEG that complements your article. Authors should be staff members or board members of the organization. Call me at 432-352-0605 to confirm that I have received it. Approved submissions will run in a viewpoints section or in an edition on Tuesday through Friday. There will not be a set place for these submissions. Here is one last thing for our readers as they think about a December donation. Please also remember that the yearly donation day, known as Permian Basin Gives, has been moved to February 21st in 2023. Permian Basin Gives is a one-day event encouraging area residents to create meaningful impact through the nonprofits that serve our community, according to its website. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled, Oil Holds Gains, Ahead of OPEC Plus Uncertainty, by Julia Fanzeres and Elena Peng, Bloomberg. Oil held on to gains as market uncertainty over OPEC's upcoming decision on production tugged the price in opposite directions. West Texas Intermediate rose 1.2% to settle above $78 Tuesday after trading in a $3 range. Volatility was expected to rise in the days leading up to the meeting this weekend as traders searched for any clue on how OPEC and its allies will respond to deteriorating market conditions for producers. The shape of the futures curve has flipped in recent weeks, signaling an oversupplied market. OPEC Plus does not like contango, and that is what has raised market expectations of deeper cuts. Amrita Sen, chief oil analyst at consultant Energy Aspects, said in a Bloomberg TV interview, "I'm not ruling out deeper cuts. That's, of course, on the table. But I would say that's not our base case." Earlier in the session, prices rallied above $79 a barrel after Beijing said it would bolster vaccination among seniors, a move regarded by health experts as crucial for reopening the economy of the world's biggest crude importer. Prices briefly flirted with losses after Reuters reported that the production cartel would stick with its current oil output policy, citing unidentified people. On Monday, Bloomberg reported that OPEC Plus may consider supply cuts to counter market weakness, a move that could potentially deepen curbs agreed to last time members convened in October. Oil has lost about 9% this month, as a deteriorating physical market revealed slackening demand. The OPEC Plus gathering precedes a deadline for European Union curbs on Russian flows, as the bloc struggles to agree on a price cap. Concerns that tighter monetary policy will slow consumption as well as doubts about demand in China prompted OPEC Plus to announce a major output cut last month. The weakening at the front of the oil futures curve has been precipitous. On Monday, Brent's nearest time spread closed at its weakest level since 2020, a sign of oversupply. Until this month, it had been in the opposite structure all year. This article is entitled, "State's Grid Operator Expects to be Prepared for Winter Energy Usage," by Mark Chediak, Bloomberg. Texas expects to have enough power supply on hand to meet energy demand this winter, although officials warn the threat of blackouts remains under the most extreme weather. The state has about 87,300 megawatts of capacity available in the winter season, while demand is forecast to peak at 67,398 megawatts, the Texas grid operator said in a report released Tuesday. 1 megawatt is enough to power 200 Texas homes. Still, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas warns that rotating outages may be required in an unlikely scenario of high demand, with extreme unplanned outages and low wind output. The Texas grid remains under scrutiny after the system collapsed during a deadly storm in February 2021, leaving much of the state without power for days. Since then, state officials ordered a number of power market reforms, including requirements that power plant operators ensure their generators can operate under extreme cold. "We are better prepared than ever," Public Utility Commission Chairman Peter Lake said Tuesday in a press conference about the report. "I expect the lights to stay on." Lake and ERCOT President Pablo Vegas acknowledged that more work needs to be done to strengthen the grid, noting that population growth is pushing up electricity demand, while the amount of generation that can be called on at a moment's notice hasn't increased. The state is working on additional reforms to its power market to ensure there is enough reliable power supply, the officials said. To that end, state regulators proposed a system that would require electricity providers to buy credits from power generators to guarantee they would have enough electricity to meet increased demand during times of grid stress. This article is entitled, "IEA Leader Wants OPEC Plus to Be More Globally Conscious," by Carrie Lundgren, Bloomberg. OPEC Plus should take into account the very fragile state of the global economy when deliberating deeper supply cuts during their upcoming meeting, the head of the International Energy Agency said Tuesday. "It will be very important that the OPEC Plus countries consider the very fragile global economic situation," IEA Executive Director Fatih Birol said in an interview. "Some of their main clients are about to slide into recession." Ministers' meeting this weekend also should take note of conditions in developing countries, he said. International oil prices remain high, stoking inflation and posing a headwind for economic activity. The OPEC Plus alliance, led by Saudi Arabia, nonetheless announced production cuts this month and next, a move Birol wants the group to reconsider. Saudi Energy Minister Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman has defended the cuts. This is the obituary column, Wednesday, November 30th. Forrest Riggs. Forrest Riggs, born February 16, 1922, was welcomed into heaven on November 17th, when the Lord decided that after 100 years, it was time for him to come home. He was born and raised on the family farm in Yoakum, Texas, to parents Ethel May and Elihu Riggs. Forrest is preceded in death by his parents, brother Raymond and sister Eulalie, and daughter Vicki Williams. He is survived by daughters Vaughn Bradley and Valerie Piper, grandchildren Miranda Williamson, Allie Williams, and Dylan Williams, and great-granddaughters Ellie Hoffman and Charlotte Gregory. Former sons-in-law Ron Piper and Brad Williams remained close to him as well. Visitation will be held Friday, December 2nd at Ellis Funeral Home from 6 to 8 p.m. The celebration of life service will be held Saturday, December 3rd at 1 p.m. at Ellis Funeral Home Chapel, with a reception to follow. In lieu of flowers, donations in Forrest's name can be made to St. Paul United Methodist Church or the charity of your choice. Jimmy Darrell Oglesby Sr. On Monday, November 28th, Jimmy Darrell Oglesby Sr., loving husband and father of four, passed away at age 85. He was born on July 4, 1937, in Waco, Texas, to Ambrose and Emma Jane Oglesby, née McAdams. His siblings were George Nita Dibby Rickerson, deceased sister Minnie Jean Alfie, deceased sister Brose J. Ogilby, Red, deceased brother Nevada Joy Nolan, sister living in Kennedy, Texas. He is survived by his loving wife, Sally L. Oglesby, née Arp, married 52 years, and four children, Larry Keith Henney, Stephanie Ann Barker, Jimmy Darrell Oglesby Jr., and Jason Ambrose Oglesby, 10 grandchildren, 5 great-grandchildren, and a host of other nieces and nephews. Services for Jimmy Oglesby will be held as a private family event. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made to the Alzheimer's Association or hospice in memory of Jimmy D. Oglesby. Kenneth Lee Casseroler. Kenneth Lee Casseroler passed from his earthly home to arrive at his heavenly home on November 25th. Kenneth was born to Kenneth and Frida Casseroler in Beaumont, Texas, on December 16, 1939. Kenneth is survived by his wife, Fela, his two children, Kenny Casseroler, Susan, of Lumberton, Texas, and Sherry Casseroler Roblier, Brian, of Katy, Texas. Also three stepchildren, Brent Smith, Allison, Tamara Smith Humphreys, and Sheldon Smith Laura. He is also survived by 14 grandchildren and 9 great-grandchildren. The service will be held at 10 a.m. Wednesday, November 30th at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel. Interment will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. You are invited to contribute to your local charity or Midland Christian School in lieu of flowers. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Peggy Ellis Lee. Peggy Ellis Lee of Midland passed away on November 25th at the age of 62. Peggy was born in Midland to Leroy Ellis Sr. and Reba Irene Gibson Ellis. Peggy was preceded in death by her husband, James Lee, her parents Leroy Ellis Sr. and Reba Irene Gibson Ellis, as well as three sisters and two brothers. Peggy is survived by her four children, Candace Ellis, Darrell Williams, Datron Williams, and Michael Duane Williams, as well as eight grandchildren, three brothers and two sisters. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home, and online condolences may be made at www.nallypickleandwelch.com. www.npwelch.com. Teresa Longoria Sanchez. Teresa Longoria Sanchez, 68, of Midland, passed away November 26th. She joins in heaven her father and mother, Daniel and Beatrice Longoria. She is survived by her husband, Freddie Sanchez, daughter, Sandy Sheriff, brother, Ray Longoria, sisters, Carol Tarango, Dolores Segovia, Rafaela Romero, Lucy Perez, Rosa Lujan, as well as many grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Teresa is preceded in death by her brothers, Manuel Rodarte, Joe Rodarte, and Daniel Longoria Jr. Public visitation will be held on Wednesday, November 30th, from 6 to 9 p.m., with a rosary at 7 p.m. We invite you to join the family at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home and Chapel. Online condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.llewellyngarciapipkinfh.com. Tommy Haney. Tommy Haney, 80, of Midland, passed away on November 24th. The family will hold a private service at a later date. Tommy was born on November 17, 1942, in Midland, to Melvin and Margaret Haney. He is preceded in death by his wife, Beverly. He is survived by daughters Teresa Wright of Midland and Barbara Deonde and husband Alan of Plano, as well as three grandchildren and one great-grandson. In lieu of flowers, the family requests memorials be made to Midland Animal Shelter Adoptables, P.O. Box 6016, Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home, and online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Wanda Faye Hines. Wanda Faye Hines, at the age of 85, passed away November 25th. Wanda was born in Fort Worth, Texas, on August 31st, 1937, to parents Lillian Grace and Hallie Clay Allen. Wanda is survived by two sons, Chris and Cliff, and their wives Kendra and Angela, and her daughter Charlotte. She has six remaining grandchildren and eight great-grandchildren. Wanda was preceded in death by her husband of 60 years, Charles Edward Hines, who she met in high school. The viewing will be from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. Thursday, December 1st, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. The graveside ceremony will be held Thursday, December 1st, at 11 a.m. at Rest Haven Cemetery. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Willie Mae McMurray. Willie Mae Cunning McMurray, 86, passed away November 21st. Willie Mae was born August 11, 1936, in Electra, Texas, to Selma Augusta Call Conning and Willie Ernest Conning. Willie Mae was preceded in death by her parents, her brothers Clarence Conning and Elber Conning, and nephews David Conning and Don Conning. Willie Mae, or May May to her grandchildren, is survived by her sons and their wives, Laddie and Linda McMurray, and Teddy and Debbie McMurray, as well as four grandchildren and nine great-grandchildren. She is also survived by her sister-in-law, Eva May Conning, nephew Mike Conning, and favorite cousin, Mary Sue Bessonette. Graveside services are scheduled for 3 p.m. on Saturday, December 3rd at Rest Haven Memorial Park, with Pastor Steve Weaver officiating. In lieu of flowers, memories to the Alzheimer's Association would be appreciated. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home, and online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Death notices. Linda Wiest. Linda Wiest, 83, of Midland, passed away November 25th. Memorial service will be held at 2 p.m. Saturday, December 10th, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel. She is survived by her sister, Jane Vitrano. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home, and online condolences may be made at www.nallypickleandwelch.com. www.npwelch.com. Margaret Eugenia Jeannie Bailey, 94, of Midland, passed away November 23rd. Memorial service will be held at 3 p.m. Friday, December 2nd at Nellie Pickelin Welch Funeral Home. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Maria G. Rios. Maria G. Rios, 81, of Big Spring, passed away on November 22nd. Maria was born in Marfa, Texas, on November 11th, 1941, to Raimundo and Anastasia Lujan. Visitation will be held Wednesday, November 30th, from 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. at Stanton Memorial Funeral Home Chapel, with a rosary starting at 7 p.m. Funeral Mass will be held at 10 a.m. Thursday, December 1st, at St. Joseph Catholic Church. Interment will follow at St. Joseph Catholic Cemetery. Survivors include her daughter, Sandra Rios, Norma Lee Rios, sons Leroy Rios, Edward Rios, Bobby Rios, Jesse Rios, two sisters, a brother, five grandchildren, and two great-grandchildren. Arrangements are entrusted to Stanton Memorial Funeral Home and Chapel.
Salvation Army pleads for volunteers, employees. Shelter won't open during cold weather without more help. The Odessa Salvation Army has so few volunteers and employees, they've called for a two-month moratorium on their soup kitchen and are in danger of not being able to open its homeless shelter during inclement weather. Prior to Major Luis Melendez's arrival in June of 2021, the shelter lost several staff and volunteers during the pandemic. It also lost staff when the city of Odessa found several code violations following a bathroom remodel project and the shelter couldn't fully open, Major Luis Melendez said. It took several months, but the shelter is now up to code with a brand new fire alarm and suppression system, Melendez said. That's what's upsetting, Melendez said. Everything here is ready to go, but I don't have employees. The Salvation Army has not been able to replace volunteers or crucial staffing positions for months. He is currently searching for a cook, shelter manager, and shelter monitors. He's also looking for a truck driver who can pick up donations for their thrift shop. For me, it's incomprehensible that I don't have a pool of folks or corporations or families or individuals that I can tap on and call in to help us. Everybody's busy, Melendez said. The Salvation Army's human resource director slash office manager spent the last 6 months filling in as the cook for the daily soup kitchen, but because of her other duties during the busy holiday season, they stopped providing meals November the 1st, Melendez said. This is our time for the coat drive, toy drive, angel tree, kettle collection. Melendez said up until November 1st, the soup kitchen was supplying dinner to anywhere from 12 to 30 people, Melendez said. While not all of them are homeless, many of them are struggling financially and food insecure, he said. We've got families with a lot of kids, and they'll come in with 3, 4, 5 family members, Melendez said. For them, it's either do I buy food and not pay my bills, or pay the bills and let me get food at the Salvation Army because at least there's supper there. Nowadays, Melendez believes many of them are seeking help from Jesus House and other churches. The city of Odessa has been allowing them to open an emergency inclement temporary shelter when the temperatures dip below 32 degrees overnight, Melendez said. However, because of the staffing issues, they were only open 5 days last winter, and they're already missed some opportunities to open this year, he said. With overnight temps expected to dip overnight Wednesday, Melendez said he reached out to two pastor friends, and they are trying to find volunteers within their congregations. If unsuccessful, the shelter simply can't open, he said. To make matters even worse, Melendez said he started out with two bell ringers this year, plus himself. Due to health concerns, he's now down to one bell ringer and himself, and due to his other obligations, which include interviewing job candidates, he's only able to ring in the afternoons. Last year, he and four bell ringers brought in more than $69,000 in donations. He has jumped At every opportunity, he's been given to speak to civil groups and churches about the need for volunteers and staff, Melinda said. They've also sought help through the mail, Facebook, and their website. A lot of people don't know that behind the scenes or behind the shield, I'm calling, I'm texting, or emailing, I'm trying. I was told one time, well, you're not asking enough. Well, I'm asking until I don't have a voice anymore, Melinda said. Melinda said even the Salvation Army's advisory board, which should be 15 to 16 members, is down to 6. If there's a coalition of churches and other nonprofits who help those in need, he's unaware of it. Such a group would be wonderful, but he's just too busy to spearhead such an effort. The Salvation Army's 10 employees are still able to run its utility assistance program, thrift store, and monthly food bank, but it's been difficult, Melinda said. In 2021, nearly 2,300 people received assistance from the Odessa Salvation Army, whether it was food boxes, clothing and furniture vouchers, clothing or utility assistance, he said. Nearly 8,000 meals were served. On top of that, hundreds of families received assistance during the holidays with food and toys. Hiring attempts have not gone well for several reasons, Melinda said. Some people have been unwilling to work for the wages they are offering, while others can't pass a criminal background check or are unqualified, he said. The few people they have hired haven't bothered to show up on their first day. They were excited about a shelter manager applicant in California until he demanded moving and housing expenses and $35 an hour, Melinda said. They want what I've learned to be is petroleum pay. We don't have that. I'm going to be honest. We're not competitive with even McDonald's. We can't pay $18 an hour. We are offering 11, 12, or 15, and 15 is at the management level. And that's non-negotiable, Melinda said. They've had cook applicants whose only experience was feeding their own families. He showed one applicant their pantry and asked her how she'd cook for 40 people. She says, well, you would have to tell me. I don't know, Melinda said. So that's a non-hire able person. He's been surprised by the number of people who have applied with criminal histories. You might ask, why is the Salvation Army so strict? But we're not strict. We're flagging those who are sex offenders and people with arrest warrants. We're not going to hire somebody who has an arrest warrant because then they'll get arrested and we'll have just lost an employee, Melinda said. He's actually had two men apply for the truck driving position who didn't even have a driver's license. Grants provide hands-on learning at Carver. The team of Don Paquette and Tantum Rowe have been making things grow and creating excitement about insects and steam at Carver Early Education Center for many years. Rowe recently received a $1,000 grant from the Education Foundation for Insects and Metamorphosis. Watch me grow. Paquette received a $6,500 grant for steaming our way through early childhood and $500 for How Does Your Garden Grow? STEAM stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, Art, and Math. Paquette had been awarded grants before, but Rowe had not. Paquette had been with ECISD for 34 years, with Carver, 17. Rowe has been with the district for 9 years, 2 years at Milam, and 7 at Carver. Carver has mostly 4-year-old students, but there are 3-year-olds with special needs as well. I've done the garden one since 2017, and so it's a reoccurring grant, Paquette said. And then Miss Rowe kind of piggybacked on it and extended it by doing the insects that we release in the garden at the end of the unit. Rowe said they have 3 different insects, ladybugs, caterpillars, and ants. The ladybugs and the caterpillars, they get to watch them go through their stages from egg to adult, Rose said. They just watch the ants do their thing. Rose said those bugs were selected because it's easy for children to see how they change. Those are 3 of the major insects that we touch on in our theme for insects and critters. The ants, we talk about the body parts, the thorax, the head, the abdomen. We learned about those, so that covers our ants and helps that visual. from our insects, we go into a theme called changes, and that helps us with the metamorphosis, Rose said. Paquette added that they're really cool. The students like to check on the insects every day to see what they're eating and how they're growing. Rose said they used campus money to get the habitats 2 years ago. We did it last year, and then I wrote a grant this year to keep it going through a reoccurring grant. So we have all of the habitats. We just have to get our insects back in and new books to learn about them as we go to incorporate literacy, Rowe added. Paquette said after they let the insects go, the students look for them. They find a lot of them, Paquette added. Rowe noted that students also learn how to take care of something. They know we have to be gentle with them, and insects are good. We need them. We don't kill them, Rowe said. Paquette said the students learn a lot from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. It's a big growth year, Paquette said. From 0 to 5 is huge in language development, and so that's what we were super focused on, is language development. After watching the insects and looking at the habitat, Rose said you can usually ask any child in the hallway how their ants are doing and what are their ladybugs doing. For example, students tell the teachers their larvae. They learn the vocabulary that goes with them. They're in a cocoon. We have to wait. They're learning the vocabulary that goes with it. They are learning that it's a process and it's a time, Rose said. They order the insects from Insect Lore. Rose said they arrive within a week, and she and a helper deliver the insects to classrooms and talk about what the students are going to do and what they're going to see. Some of our classrooms do have the manipulatives, like plastic caterpillars, eggs, and the cocoon, to show the stages, but not all of them, so that's something we'll work on too, Rose said. The campus's small garden had tomatoes, 3 kinds of peppers, squash, zucchini, cantaloupe, watermelon, honeydew, a grapevine, a peach tree, a lemon tree, and an herb garden with peppermint, strawberry mint, lemon balm, sage, and lavender. Because our kids are only here 1 year, most of them, they plant in the spring for the new kids that are coming. When the kids get here, there's just a huge garden, and they get to harvest it. Then the next spring, they plant it for the next batch of kids. We also have a little area of wildflowers, and we just had sunflowers everywhere that were gorgeous, Paquette said. Steaming Our Way Through Early Childhood features educational Legos. Some of the Legos have letters on them to practice their letters, building their names, building words, Paquette said. One of the sets is a train, and it's basic coding. It has different colors, and each color tells the train something different to do. So they decide what they want the train to do, and they lay that color down on the track to make the train either reverse or turn the light on or the horn, Paquette said. Rose said it will also make a sound like it's going over water. Paquette said she would definitely encourage other teachers to apply for Education Foundation grants. It's very easy to get an education grant. The way they have it set up, it's not hard at all. We've gotten lots of great grants here at Carver, and your school gets to keep the stuff forever, so it's definitely worth it, Paquette said. Everything they do at Carver is hands-on, and that's why these grants are so important to them. Quick hits. Help fill the stocking. Generous donations today have changed the 2022 total raised so far from $0 to $10,150. The 28th year of the Empty Stocking Fund started last week with a $100,000 goal to meet the needs in our community. Funds stay in Ector County and help needy families. The Empty Stocking Fund, an annual fundraising effort by the Odessa American and the Salvation Army, will continue through December the 17th. Empty stocking funds go for a good holiday meal and small gifts under the tree for needy seniors and children. Donations to the Empty Stocking Fund may be mailed or delivered to the Salvation Army Community Center, 810 East 11th Street, or the Odessa American, 700 North Grant, Suite 800. Zip codes for both are 79761. Call the Salvation Army at 332-0738. The Empty Stocking Fund was created by the Odessa American in 1995 and has raised more than $2.1 million. The West Texas Food Bank has scheduled food assistance times from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Wednesdays at the Odessa Pantry, 411 South Pagewood Avenue, and from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Thursdays at the Midland Pantry, 1601 Westcliff Drive in Midland. Woman believed to be 1971 kidnap victim reunites with family. A woman whose family members believed was the toddler who was kidnapped by a babysitter 51 years ago reunited with her family in Fort Worth in a meeting filled with long overdue hugs and joyful tears. Melissa Highsmith was 22 months old when she was abducted by a purported babysitter in 1971. The Fort Worth Star-Telegram reported that she lived in Fort Worth most of her life as Melanie Brown and didn't know she was kidnapped until her biological father, Jeffrey Highsmith, submitted DNA to 23andMe and learned that he was a match to Brown's children. The family said in a news release that they worked with an amateur genealogist to help interpret the DNA results and mine public records to find Melissa, who reunited with her parents and two of her siblings this weekend. It was just a mixture of joy and terrifying, being terrified and excited and just trying to understand, you know, make sense of everything, Melissa Highsmith told KDFW-TV. In a statement Monday, the Fort Worth Police Department said it's overjoyed to hear that 23andMe led the Highsmiths to Melissa, and they will conduct official DNA testing to confirm her identity. The investigation into her kidnapping will continue. Local news roundup. Stop leads to numerous arrests. Two men were arrested on felony drug charges early Thanksgiving morning after being stopped in a stolen car on West 3rd Street. According to an Odessa Police Department report, officers pulled over a Nissan Altima in the 500 block of West 3rd Street around 1 a.m. Thursday, knowing the car had been reported stolen to OPD. The driver, Zachary Brazil of Odessa, admitted he probably had illegal items on him, and officers found baggies of methamphetamine and marijuana on him or near the driver's side seat. They also found a container of THC in his seat, according to the report. When searching the back seat area, officers found a Smith & Wesson handgun and a Nike backpack containing methamphetamine, 12 oxycodone pills the officers believe may have been laced with fentanyl, 78 prescription-only muscle relaxant pills, scales, and baggies, the report also stated. Brazil, 40, and his front seat passenger, in separate interviews, told officers they agreed to give their back seat passenger, Jose Ornelas, 37, a ride from Andrews to Odessa in exchange for meth, the report stated. They further said Ornelas had the Nike backpack and the gun when they picked him up. Ornelas, a Lovington, New Mexico resident, denied owning any of the property in the car, but acknowledged as a convicted felon he's not supposed to be around guns, the report stated. Brazil was arrested on suspicion of unauthorized use of a motor vehicle, possession of a controlled substance, 2 counts, and possession of marijuana. One of the drug charges is a third-degree felony punishable by 2 to 10 years in prison. The other counts are less serious charges. He remained in the Ector County Jail Tuesday on surety bonds totaling $30,500. Ornelas was arrested on suspicion of manufacture/delivery of a controlled substance, 2 counts, possession of a dangerous drug, and felon in possession of a firearm. One of the drug charges is a first-degree felony punishable by 5 years to life in prison. The other charges are less serious felonies. He remained in the Ector County Jail Tuesday on surety bonds totaling $61,500. Man accused of evading cops. Dash and street cameras gave Odessa police officers the probable cause they needed to arrest an Odessa man with a history of evading arrest on an evading arrest charge Monday. According to an Odessa Police Department report, an officer was traveling east in the 400 block of East 8th Street on the evening of November the 12th when he saw a Dodge Ram 1500 almost rear-end another car while traveling at an extremely high rate of speed. The officer tried to pull the driver over, but he sped up and went through the red light at 7th Street and Grant, the report stated. Due to OPD policies regarding pursuits, the officer did not pursue the truck. Several hours later, officers found a truck matching the description of the Dodge Ram parked facing traffic on the south curb line just east of Place on 6th Avenue and identified Alfredo Acosta, 33, as the driver, the report stated. After showing Acosta dash cam video of him blowing the red light at 7th Street and Grant, and after telling him other street cameras caught him driving the truck, Acosta admitted he took off from the officer because he was afraid of going back to prison, the report stated. According to the report, Acosta has been convicted in Midland and Ector counties on evading charges in the past. A warrant was issued for his arrest, and he was booked into the Ector County Jail Monday on suspicion of evading arrest or detention with a vehicle and with previous convictions. It's a third-degree felony punishable by 2 to 10 years in prison. No bond had been set as of Tuesday morning. Odessa's song lands at number 8. Odessa recording artist Erica Lane is back with the new Christmas single, The Friendly Beasts. For the week ending November the 25th, The Friendly Beast landed at number 8 on the New Music Weekly's Indie Music Single Chart and number 61 on the Hot 100, ahead of new singles from Shania Twain, Black Eyed Peas, Charli D'Amelio, and more. The single also debuted at number 42 on Billboard's Monitored AC Adult Contemporary Chart and number 55 on the Media Base Monitored AC Chart. The Friendly Beast was recorded at the Blue Rock Artist Ranch and Studio in Wimberley. Lane's arrangement of the Old English tune is a nod to the animals that may have been present at the time of Christ's birth. The song illustrates the importance of the Lord's coming as a blessing to the lives of all creatures on the earth. Musicians Scott Mulvahill and Tim Fierst contributed to the recording, which was engineered by John Zaola and mixed by Mike Rogers. It feels great to see such a positive response to my single, The Friendly Beast, Lane said in a news release. For the last few years, I've had to shift my focus to some pretty serious life things, and being able to release music again in this season is a huge blessing. The song is organic, hopeful, and nostalgic. It leaves you with a sense of thankfulness for the gifts that God gave through the birth of His Son. A music video will be released in early December. Hawaii eruption has some on alert. The first eruption in 38 years of the world's largest active volcano is attracting onlookers to a national park for spectacular views of the event. And it's also dredging up bad memories among some Hawaii residents who have been through harrowing volcanic experiences in the past. It was just 4 years ago that Nicole Skilling fled her home near a community where more than 700 residents were destroyed by lava. She relocated to the South Kona area, only to find herself packing her car with food and supplies this week after Mauna Loa erupted late Sunday. Officials were initially concerned that lava flowing down the side of the volcano would head toward South Kona, but scientists later assured the public that the eruption migrated to a rift zone on Mauna Loa's northeast flank and wasn't threatening any communities. Still, the uncertainty is somewhat unnerving. It just happened last night, so I really haven't had a lot of time to worry about it yet, basically, Skilling said Monday. And thankfully, right now, it's at the northeast rift zone. And if it breaks on the west side, that's when we're talking about coming into a large populated area. That's why I do have a little bit of PTSD. Even though there were no evacuation orders, some people decided to leave their homes, prompting officials to open shelters in the Kona and Kauai areas. Very few, if any, stayed in them overnight, Hawaii County Mayor Mitch Roth said, and they would be closing Tuesday. Clearly, the danger for the Kauai area and Kona area has gone, so there's really no need to have the shelter up there any longer, Roth said. Despite that, some in the area were preparing for unpredictable changes. A half-day holiday bill. Your true love will face a hefty bill this year to buy all the gifts listed in the 12 Days of Christmas song because the price of 5 golden rings and several other gifts soared this year. The total cost of the gifts and performances in the 2-century-old English carol rose faster than inflation this year, reaching $45,523.27. That's 10.5% higher than last year, well above the current 7.7 consumer inflation, which itself is still near the highest in 4 decades. PNC Assessment Management Group's annual report is a whimsical way of tracking inflation. The gold rings cost True Love 39% more this year because jewelry prices soared after investors sought out the precious metal, and they haven't fallen even though the price of gold has dropped. But 2 turtle doves, 3 French hens, 10 lords a-leaping, and the pear tree all cost more than 24% more than last year. This is a disquieting development for many as pandemic-related supply chain disruptions and elevated energy and commodity prices continue to impact the cost of goods and services, said Amanda Agate, Chief Investment Officer for PNC Assessment Management Group. Los Posados show set. To celebrate Los Posados, University of Texas Permian Basin is hosting a Christmas show at 7 p.m. December the 1st at the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center. Vendors and food trucks start at 4 p.m. and admission is free. Los Posados is a religious festival celebrated in Mexico and some parts of the United States between December the 16th and 24th. Los Posados commemorates the journey that Joseph and Mary made from Nazareth to Bethlehem in search of a safe refuge where Mary could give birth to the baby Jesus, according to Britannica.com. It will include the mariachi, ballet folklorico, UTPB, and OC choirs, the UTPB orchestra, and community members. The idea is to kind of picture Mary and Joseph finding lodging before Jesus is born. The whole thing is even related to Las Pintas, professor and orchestra director Jean Gomez said. The 7 points of the pinata symbolize the 7 deadly sins. In the show, we will have the participation of the orchestra, mariachi, ballet, folklorico. This year, we even include the Odessa College Choir, Gomez said. Most of the music is more like oral tradition songs, Gomez said. A few of the songs are popular tunes, and Gomez arranged the music. He added that these events take him about 6 months to organize.